All right, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. First thing I'd like to say is it's really great to be here and get to speak in front of an entire lecture hall full of atheists. Okay, Ben's, yes. Okay, you're wondering what I mean by that. Well, you know, certainly we may disagree on, say, Christianity or one of the mainstream religions, but we are all atheists with respect to Zeus and Ra and Wotan. As Richard Dawkins is fond of saying, we are all atheists with respect to most of the gods societies have ever believed in. Some of us just go one god further. This is kind of a nice soundbite, but I think there's a broader principle involved here. It's been called the outsider test. The outsider test is a term coined by the philosopher John Loftus, who's a former evangelical Christian who over the course of his studies ended up becoming an atheist and recently came out with a book called Why I Rejected Christianity. And one of the things he notes in this book is that people's beliefs are largely determined by upbringing. 80% of Americans say that they believe that the Bible is the word of God, but most of those people, had they grown up in India, would probably be Hindu, or if they'd grown up in the Middle East, would be Muslim. This isn't really a good thing. We want our beliefs to be determined by what's true, not just by what our parents told us. So the proposal for the outsider test is test your beliefs as if you are an outsider to the faith you are evaluating. This seems like kind of a simple idea, but so I'm going to just give a couple examples of how you can apply this. For example, many Christians will say that just their own personal stories of how Christianity changed their life is evidence of Christianity. In response to this, let me read you a quote. When one fervently believes something to be true, he lives by it. Any set of ideas fervently believed and applied will transform believers and their culture. And when the author I'm quoting says any set, he means any set regardless of whether or not it's true. This is the sort of thing you might expect to hear a skeptic say about Christianity, but it's actually a quote from a Christian writer, Norman Geisler, responding to the claims of Muslims. Or look at the issue of miracles. You know, some Christians claim that there's strong historical evidence for the miracles of Jesus, and a lot of those arguments can be deflated just by asking, would anybody buy these arguments if they were put forward for some Hindu guru or some Hindu claiming to be a Hindu god incarnate? And the other point I think this helps wrap up is just the definition of atheism, which the debate can get somewhat drawn out and obscure how to define it. In terms of the position I'm going to be defending tonight, I'm just going to understand atheism to be the idea that we should view the mainstream gods the way most people view the gods of ancient Greece. And notice here that most people don't worry about their ability to disprove the Greek gods. And I take it to be the case that if there's no better evidence for the Greek the mainstream gods than the Greek gods, then yes, we should be atheists. Though on top of that, I think that there's a pretty strong evidential case, maybe not mathematical proof, but a pretty strong evidential case that can be made against the Christian God and any God conceived along similar lines. So go back to the issue of miracles right away. The Greek historian Herodotus, for example, reports that when the Persians attacked the temple at Delphi, there were all kinds of miracles to fend off the invasion. No historian today believes this, even though they're willing to trust Herodotus on a lot of things regarding the Greece of his time and shortly before. So why not? I think a good explanation was given by the 18th century Scottish philosopher and historian David Hume, who in his essay on miracles said, "It is strange, a judicious reader is apt to say upon perusal of these wonderful historians, that such prodigious events do not happen in our own days. But nothing is strange, I hope, that men should lie in all ages." And this is really striking because modern history tends to be much, much better documented than ancient history. So if you take the position that miracles just happened 2,000 years ago, not today, you end up saying that miracles only happen when they can't be well documented, which would be really weird. On top of that, we do see happening today fewer examples of bogus miracle claims or bogus claims of the supernatural. There was a story that made a big splash in some Christian media outlets like Pat Robertson's outlet and say about how scientists supposedly drilled down to hell and could lower down microphones and measure 2,000, lower down microphones, hear the screams of the damned and whatnot. And it turned out to be just an urban legend. Or look at the faith healers like P. Peter Popoff, who's been exposed as frauds. Today we also see, you know, examples of extraordinary claims that don't fit the traditional religious categories, psychics, alien abductions, you know, people falling off into another dimension. I don't have time to go into the details, all those are things that have been investigated and debunked. And we see those things, we don't see the real miracles. Maybe it's logically possible that, you know, it was just the real miracles happened 2,000 years ago and only fake ones happen today. But clearly the most plausible explanation is that miracles don't happen. And this is a problem for most traditional forms of theism because most of the people who've ever lived, you know, deists and Epicureans aside, most of them have conceived their gods as miracle-working gods. So if miracles don't happen, then most of the gods that humans have ever believed in don't exist. Not the Greek gods, not the Hindu gods, and certainly not the Christian God. You can find a similar issue with the problem of prayer. Again, most of the people who've ever lived have expected their gods to be gods that answer prayer. This goes down to, you know, animistic religions with nature spirits all the way up to the monotheistic gods, and certainly not something that's been dropped with monotheism. Ask and you shall receive is what the Bible says about prayer. Of course, we all know that verse, it isn't true if you take it literally. Sometimes prayers aren't answered. So then the next step is to say, well, you know, maybe are they sometimes answered? Does praying for something make it more likely to happen than not, or than otherwise? Recently the Templeton Foundation, which is an organization dedicated they're trying to reconcile science and religion, spent like $2.4 million seeing, you know, whether prayer could be, intercessory prayer could be of any benefit to cardiac patients. And they were certainly hoping for a positive result, but the result was it had no impact. So as far as we can tell, prayer doesn't work. I should also point out here that on top of, you know, being able to use science to find out that prayer, you know, doesn't work, we can also use psychology to understand why people might believe in it, even though it doesn't. Scientists have studied, the magical practices of primitive tribes, and really interesting results that magical practices tend to be associated with areas of life where there's a high degree of chance. And you can even extend that to actually the superstitions of baseball players. In baseball, the superstitious practices tend to be associated with things like hitting and pitching, not fielding, where there's fielding is a very low chance endeavor. What this suggests to psychologists is that humans are pattern-seeking creatures. We're presented with a real pattern. We can find it. But when presented with, you know, random data, we start seeing things that aren't there, causal connections that aren't there. Connections between, you know, say, praying or using some magic ritual or, not washing your socks, maybe in the case of some baseball players, and getting what you want. So basically, the bottom line is that apparently prayer and these, you know, practices to invoke gods don't work, and that's another good reason to think that those gods don't exist. A somewhat related, but much broader problem is what philosophers of religion call the problem of reasonable non-belief. And this is derived from the fact that God, as has been traditionally conceived, has been traditionally portrayed as being really, really concerned to get people to believe in him. Traditionally, many Christians and many Muslims have thought that he is so concerned to get people to believe in him that he will send anybody to hell who not only doesn't believe in him, but even if they, you know, take the wrong view of him, you know, if they're Muslims when they should be Christians or Christians when they should be Muslims. I don't know if Tim believes this. I do know that it is the official position of Campus Crusade for Christ, but even without taking it to that extreme, many people, you know, certainly believe that God has given a revelation that he wants humans to have, or that he wants to have, get to know you, have a personal relationship with you, which is a phrase some Christians use, some really dislike, but don't need to get into that now. So, yeah, for this reason, it isn't surprising that a lot of Christians actually do insist that it is just obvious that God exists. You know, they'll cite Romans, the verses like 1:18 through 20, which, you know, to say that, you know, unbelievers suppress the truth, and it's just obvious that God exists. The problem is that the book of Romans is wrong. It's not obvious that Christianity is true or any God like the Christian God exists. If it were obvious, we wouldn't be having this debate tonight. You know, like, and, you know, by the way, I should explain, you know, what I mean by obvious. Well, you know, like, the way my existence is obvious to all of you. You know, it'd be very strange to have a debate about, you know, whether I exist or whether Tim exists or whether the guy down the hall from you exists. Well, I mean, you know, maybe if it's a person who never comes out of their room, you might start to wonder. But that would be a really, yeah, that would be a really weird situation, and it's not what you'd expect out of an all-powerful God who really wants everybody to believe in him. And, you know, also, just to add to that, I want to read you a quote from the Christian writer William Lane Craig, who said, "Too often, Christian leaders give lip service to the importance of the mind and the quest after truth, but have a sort of glib confidence that such a quest will invariably wind up at the truth of Christianity. But such a result is by no means guaranteed." And this is really a striking quote from William Lane Craig. I don't know how many of you have read his writings, but he's known for claiming that you know, Christianity can be proven or at least shown to be overwhelmingly more reasonable on, you know, scientific and historical evidence and whatnot. So, but even he realizes that, you know, some people try to seek the truth and don't arrive at Christianity. So, yeah, just to sum up, I don't think the evidence for the Christian God is any better than that for the Greek gods. And we're also lacking evidence that we'd strongly expect to have if a God like that existed. Thanks. Yeah, that's right. Question. Sorry, I forgot. Yeah, I don't know who wants to have the mic for this.
Okay.
Perhaps just speak louder.
Here, you can keep it. Okay, so I guess this isn't my rebuttal. These are just a couple questions that came to mind. First is, I was wondering, how do you think your background affects your beliefs? Like, you made the claim that our beliefs are largely determined by where our upbringing, born in America, born in roughly Christian nation, et cetera.
Well, I was raised in a liberal Protestant church. I don't know quite to give my whole story. So I guess you know, it's a fairly liberal church. I didn't have to make any kind of great progress from very conservative Christianity to atheism. Though I do notice I find myself, you know, sometimes somebody, you know, people have to point out to me, you know, wait, we think this claim that this Christian leader is saying, we think it was crazy if they were Hindu, and I'm like, wait a second, I'm an atheist and I didn't see that. It's a vague question. I could go on for a while.
I didn't know if you were making a point about the rationality of belief, religious belief.
My main point was just that, you know, trying to look at religion from an outsider's perspective, it isn't really a point about the rationality, just that trying to look at it from an outsider's perspective can really change things. Okay. As you know, I gave the two or three examples.
Okay. Yeah. And then the other two questions I thought of were, what would constitute good enough evidence for a miracle, for the occurrence of a miracle?
I think it'd be really easy to get if Moses-type miracle worker came down today, you know, I mean, he performs his miracles, you know, things like turning sticks into snakes in public, the news cameras are there, you know, magicians watch the tapes and say, this doesn't look like magic. A few come up, you know, to wherever he's speaking and try to get a closer look, say this definitely isn't magic. Yeah, that's the kind of thing you could do today. And you could all report it. If that happened in a pre-literate society, even if you had people who were very good at catching trickery, it wouldn't be recorded.
So it would have to be sort of scientifically testable like that?
Yeah, testable.
Okay. Is that a minimum requirement?
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, the quickest, you know, if you ask me what it would look like, that's what comes to mind.
Okay. And a related question, I don't know how much time we have left for this, but what would constitute evidence for God's existence?
That would be a very clear case. And you could think of other things, but that would be a very clear one.
Okay.
God wanted no reason. I mean, there's literally an infinite number of possibilities that could have actually been. Why is our world the way it is? Why is it allowed for the formation of atoms and planets and stars rather than that? So the fourth argument I want to present is basically an argument that starts with from morality, basically. The first premise is that people have intrinsic moral worth, and it's not something that it's not a matter of like what we it's not a matter of our feelings. It's a matter of there's something objectively valuable about people. It's wrong to rape, pillage, murder, torture, racial bigotry. These things are objectively wrong. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks about them. They're wrong because they violate the sanctity of human persons. The second premise is that nothing has intrinsic worth on an atheistic worldview. Therefore, no atheistic worldview is true. And I'm kind of just going to take it for granted that the first premise is true. I think everybody really believes that murder and rape and all those things are literally wrong. And it doesn't matter what any of us think about it. That guy there doesn't, maybe, but... So you might say, why think the second one? Why think that nothing has intrinsic worth on an atheistic worldview? Well, I think if you look at the origin of things, if you look at where things came about, that's a pretty good clue as to whether or not there's any value to it. So if Christianity is true, then we're all made in the image of God, and there is clearly worth to people. If atheism is true, then we're the result of chance, basically. We're the result of processes that didn't care whether we existed, had no intention, it was random and purposeless, and it just doesn't seem like there can be anything of real intrinsic worth on that view. The fourth argument, or I think it's, let's see, or last thing on that one, I just want to quote an atheist philosopher, Michael Ruse, says, "Morality is a biological adaptation no less than our hands and feet and teeth. Considered as a rationally justifiable set of claims about an objective something, ethics is illusory. Morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction, and any deeper meaning is illusory." So he's denying the first premise, that persons have intrinsic moral worth. He's agreeing with me on the second one. So the last argument I want to present is an argument specifically for the truth of Christianity, a historical argument about the resurrection of Jesus. And I think there's a number of historical facts that we have very good reason to believe. The first one is that Jesus was buried in a tomb and that his early followers knew where this tomb was located. We see in all four of the Gospels of Jesus this account, and the Gospels were written based on material or based on traditions that predated the writing of the Gospels. And there's no other account of it, and they all agree in it, in the basic details of it. And second, in 1 Corinthians 15, which is a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote around probably AD 53 or so, he gives this this formula, basically, about this kind of this creed that the early church had formulated and that they passed on. And scholars date this to within probably 5 years, or they do date it, in fact, to within 5 years of Jesus' death. And part of this formula includes that Jesus was buried, that he was raised on the third day. And this is important because, if you think about it, the early followers of Jesus, if they knew where the tomb was, if they knew where Jesus was buried, then if somebody came to them claiming that Jesus was raised from the dead, probably the first thing they're going to do is go check out the tomb and see if it had been tampered with, see if there is any reason or anything to substantiate this claim. This is also important because Christianity in its early days had enemies, had people that didn't want to see Christianity succeed. And if they could have gone to this tomb and pointed to it and said, hey, the body is still there, the rock is still in front of the tomb, the jig would have been up and Christianity would never have survived beyond a couple of years, but probably more like a couple of months. The second point is that this tomb was found empty by a group of Jesus' women followers 3 days after his crucifixion at the hands of the Roman. one of the male disciples or some man discovering the tomb. So the fact that they have women discovering it is an embarrassment, basically, to the account, and it makes it highly improbable that it would have been made up. The empty tomb is also important because, as I was talking about earlier, Christianity had enemies, had people that didn't want to see it succeed. So if they could have gone and pointed to a tomb that was not empty, they certainly would have done so. And Wolfhart Pannenberg, who's a New Testament scholar, says, without having a reliable testimony for the emptiness of Jesus' tomb, the early Christian community could not have survived in Jerusalem proclaiming the resurrection of Christ. It started in the very place where its enemies were present. And it started in the presence of eyewitnesses, people that knew who Jesus was, saw him while he was alive, and knew that he had been crucified. The third point I want to talk about is just the change in the early disciples. Basically, all the early followers of Jesus were Jewish, and so we have a pretty good idea about what their beliefs were. They believed that Jesus was the Messiah, and that Jesus was crucified at the hands of the Romans, and they continued to believe that he was the Messiah. And this is this is extremely odd, because the Jewish belief at that time was that the Messiah was someone who was going to come and lead Israel to political independence. He was going to lead them to victory over the pagans. Instead, Jesus was killed, crucified by the pagans. So he was humiliated. He was completely defeated. And the fact that they continued, to believe this is remarkable. And secondly, I want to mention the Jewish belief about the resurrection. Resurrection in that day was something that their belief was that it was something that happened at the end of history to all the righteous at once, not that it was something that happened to one man in the middle of history, and so the resurrection would happen and continue on. That makes no sense within early Jewish beliefs at that time. The only real explanation for this is that Jesus was actually physically raised from the dead. If he was physically raised from the dead, God did it in Christianity.
I'll start with the cosmological argument. In his speech, Tim asked, why is there something rather than nothing? This is a question that's always really puzzled me, because God is an enormous something. You can't invoke, if you want to ask the question, why is there something and rather than nothing, you can't say, well, the answer is something. And I'm really not sure what he was getting at. I've heard he also mentioned the Big Bang, which has been used in a slightly more sophisticated version of the cosmological argument. But again, why think that the cause of the Big Bang has to be, I guess some physicists dispute that, I don't know the details, but even if the Big Bang had a cause, why think that it has to be God? It could, if the observable universe may have begun then, but there may have been some precursor, you can come up with anything, other ideas out of the hat, And you may, you know, what I've never, those ideas, whatever objections you can raise to them, I don't see how the God hypothesis comes off any better. Fine-tuning. I want to emphasize here that let some people, he didn't phrase it in terms of probability, but though some scientists, I don't know about scientists, but some defenders of this argument claim that we can know the universe is extremely improbable, and it's very unclear to me the basis for that claim, though, again, he didn't make it, though I did think it was interesting because he cited Quentin Smith, who's a philosopher, and he does think that the universe is improbable, but his what he said is that there's strong scientific evidence that the initial conditions of the universe were assigned at random. If that's true, the initial conditions of the universe were not designed. I don't have the scientific expertise to evaluate that claim, but at any rate, there's no basis for assuming that it just automatically works in favor of God. And also, without the probability claim, it seems to boil down to how did we get a universe with life in it? But again, just like the with the cosmological argument, you can ask, how did we get so lucky to have a universe with a God in it to design us? So again, it's not clear exactly what's going on there. The main question, I think the key point of this argument, the way he phrased it, is that where things came from determines their worth. And I don't really see any reason to think that this is true. It seems to me that the reason that humans have worth that cabbages don't, for example, to use a really clear-cut case. I mean, I don't know if we have any animal rights people in this. I don't want to get to the question of whether animals have worth, because that's another debate. But it seems to me the reason for that is because of the human ability to have art and to dream about the future and to do all the things that humans do and that cabbages don't. It's not a matter of where we came from. And even if our worth is a matter of where we came from, it's not clear that Christianity helps a lot here. I was just reading a passage of the Bible, it's Romans chapter 9, where St. Paul is answering the question of the accusation that theistic morality is arbitrary, which is a very common one. You'll sometimes hear, if God exists, everything is permissible, as it has been put. God could order you to crash planes into buildings, and it would be right. And I think Paul is specifically dealing with the issue of God sending people to hell. And you know what his response is? His response is, you are a piece of clay to God. He can do whatever he wants with you. You can take the view that on theism, you're just sort of this plaything of a super being. You can turn that argument around very easily. Now to the resurrection. He spent a lot of time on this, so I'm going to try to cover it in detail, though there's a lot of detail here. The first thing to emphasize here is that pretty much the only evidence for Jesus' resurrection is the books of the Bible, the Gospels, and he also mentioned one of Paul's letters, and that's pretty much it. The Gospels, I know that he didn't make this clear. The Christian church has claimed that they were written by apostles and the companions of apostles, but in recent years, last couple centuries since biblical scholarship has really taken off, this is a claim that's been seriously questioned, including by fairly moderate scholars like Raymond Brown. There are several reasons for this. One big one is that, you see the titles Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Textual scholars comparing different manuscripts have worked out that those names were a later addition. And that's something that even like Craig Blomberg concedes. And Craig Blomberg is a guy who's scholar who's known for defending that claim that the Bible is inerrant and that they really were written by these guys. But even he admits that the titles were added earlier. So the grounds for thinking that these are eyewitness reportage is pretty weak. Tim mentioned some arguments about, if this were invented, they wouldn't have told the story that way with the women and such. But think about this. Transport yourself, back to I'm not sure if the story would have been circulating on the internet, but remember the scientists drill down to hell story? That's a story that eventually got on the internet. Imagine you get that story. It's hearsay, no strong confirmation. Are you going to look at it and say, I bet that they wouldn't have told it this way if it were just a legend. No, you're going to want some stronger confirmation, some first-hand confirmation before you believe the story. So the Gospels really aren't very good evidence for the resurrection of Jesus or any of the other miracles they record. It's possible that they were based on actual events. We have people who falsely claim miraculous healing powers today. I mentioned Peter Popoff in my opening speech. It's possible Jesus was one of those guys, for example, but there's no reason to treat them as good evidence for actual miracles. And then the second thing he cited was 1 Corinthians. Most scholars think that Paul really did write 1 Corinthians, but again, it's very brief, and it doesn't have any of the sort of details that you find in the Gospels, and notably, it doesn't have any mention of Jesus' tomb being found empty. We know it was written before the Gospels, and we can know who wrote it. So that's actually something that some scholars have cited, questioning whether Jesus' tomb really was empty, or even if he was buried in the sort of tomb described in the Gospels. He doesn't even say it could have been a grave burial, for all Paul says. And he mentions people seeing Jesus, but again, we have ancient inscriptions that talk about allegedly people saw the Greek gods. Or today you can find people who think that they've had post-mortem conversations with Elvis. They really think that, or they really think they've been abducted by aliens, another thing I mentioned in my opening speech. There are several possibilities like this, as far as I can tell, the evidence that 1 Corinthians provides for Jesus' resurrection isn't really any better than the evidence for Elvis or for the ghosts that have been reported in my hometown, the opera house in my hometown. And also, the argument about who would die for a lie, look up Joseph Smith and Jim Jones. There's strong evidence that occasionally liars do make martyrs. So that possibility isn't ruled out either. Thank you. Okay. I knew I was a little short on time.
Big disanalogy, and I would say just the fact that all you guys not on par with Zeus. And he talked a little bit about miracles and just about, he mentioned David Hume. Hume has a really famous objection to miracles, basically saying that if we look at what our experience today, or if we look at general human experience, there aren't any well-attested miracles. We don't see miracles happening every day. Therefore, it's more rational to believe that people are lying or somehow mistaken if they attest to a miracle. And the first thing I'd like to say about that is he pretty blatantly begs the question by saying there aren't any well-attested miracles. Maybe not by saying that they're happening today like we see them happening every day, but if you think about what is a miracle? A miracle isn't something that happens regularly like the laws of nature. A miracle is by definition either a suspension of the laws of the natural laws or a violation of them, however you want to formulate it. So it shouldn't surprise us that miracles, if they happen, are rare and they're not something that's seen every day. And secondly, I argue that there are people, there is at least one alleged case of a miracle that has pretty strong evidence to back it up, and that would be the resurrection of Jesus. I wouldn't argue the same thing about the fact that Jesus walked on water or something like that, because the evidence that we can have today regarding that is on par with other things that Chris mentioned, but Jesus' resurrection is not. Secondly, I think Hume confuses science and history. We form our scientific theories based on regularities that we see happening. We don't form our history in the same way. An event like Jesus rising from the dead, somebody could see Jesus alive, somebody Jesus dying, Jesus dead, and then you could see him raised from the dead if that in fact happened. So I don't see the problem for. I don't see that it's ruled out a priori just by that argument. And he mentioned prayer as well, and he mentioned a study that looked at the effects of prayer. And I think what this study shows us is just that God, if God in fact exists and answers prayer, or if God exists, period, he doesn't answer prayer in the same way that physical laws, scientific laws, other things that science study function. So God is not like the law of gravity. If you drop an apple, it's going to fall every single time. If you pray for something, for God to do something, it's not going to happen every single time. And Chris acknowledged this. And it says in the book of 1 John, he says, "This is the confidence we have in approaching God, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. And if we know that he hears us, whatever we ask, we know we have it. We ask of him." I want to draw attention to that part where he says, if we ask anything according to his will. So there's a qualification to that. Basically, God is a person, and if you ask, you wouldn't design a scientific study where you ask somebody to do something, and then if they refuse, you wouldn't conclude that they don't exist because they didn't act in the way that you thought that they should. You might conclude that, hey, maybe there's some reason this guy isn't acting like he thought he should. So I don't think that the study shows what Chris thinks it shows. And he spent a lot of time on the reasonable non-belief. And one point, the argument is basically that if God exists, if the Christian God exists, he cares a lot about whether or not people believe in him. And I agree. I think God does care whether or not people believe in him. But he goes on to say the fact that there are so many people who don't believe in God shows that God doesn't exist, because if God cares that people know him or believe in him, then God would certainly do something to ensure that at least a majority of the people on the earth believe in God. Well, what can be said about that? What reason might there be that God would allow people to not believe in him? And I don't think he quoted this guy, but there's a guy named Theodore Drange who writes articles, and he wrote one on posted it on infidels.org about this, presenting this argument. And he says, "It is hard to understand what God might want from us, or might want from humans, as much as their belief in a set of propositions, including that God exists, that he loves humans, and that there is an afterlife, on which depends their love and worship of him, and possibly even their own salvation." And he asks, what possible reason could there be? But it seems kind of, I was surprised when I read this, because he mentions the answer right there, and he doesn't seem to realize it. That in order for it's not enough to just believe that they exist. So it might be that God allows people to not believe in him because there's something about God that if he were to manifest himself in a way that's just blatantly obvious, would interfere with that. And to illustrate this, consider this analogy. Say there's a guy named Steve. Steve is rich, powerful, successful, good-looking. And Steve is interested in these two women, Sally and Sarah. And we'll say Sally has read her Thoreau, she's read her New Testament. She knows that power and money and prestige and all these things don't really make a person. And so if Steve were to ask her out or ask her to marry him or something like that, she's not going to be swayed by the fact that he's rich and powerful. She's going to love him for who he is. Sally, on the other hand, for whatever reason, she values these things. She values wealth and power immensely. And if Steve were to just approach her in his Mercedes-Benz, you know, and pop the question to her, she would say yes, without a doubt, because she's thinking, wow, this guy is rich, powerful, I've got it made. If you were going to try and get her to love him in such a way, he would have to conceal those aspects of him. So we see that simply believing in somebody's existence is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for a loving relationship. And it could be that, consider if God made his existence known to everyone and further made it known that there's consequences, as surely there are, if we are sinful and if we refuse to obey his loving commands, then people would probably obey him, but it wouldn't be from love, it would be from a sense of obligation. So I don't think it's unusual at all that we don't. All right, I'm done. My time's up. You get my point.
Okay.
I would say about that is that, again, I'm not a physicist. I didn't study physics. But I would ask, where's the evidence for that? Presumably, I assume if you're asking the question from a skeptical standpoint, and hopefully if you're asking it from a Christian standpoint as well, you value science and you value evidence a lot. Where would the evidence be that this happened? I don't think there really, to my knowledge, there isn't any. I'm not a physics guy again. And secondly, I would say, as far as I know, right now the Big Bang is such that it's not going to contract again. It's going and it's going to keep going until the heat death of the universe, whenever that's going to happen. And so it would seem to be, to me, really remarkable that many expansions and contractions, and that now this just happens to be the last one. Like, that would seem to be enough to defeat that.
Yeah.
He asked about where the evidence is for that theory. But you can also ask, where is the evidence, or at least independent evidence, that God fine-tuned the constants of the universe and created the Big Bang and such? This is a pattern I see a lot. Creationists will say, well, do an experiment that replicates the evolution of this feature. Why don't we catch God on camera, doing special creation? There's a double standard where any part of our current scientific worldview, you say prove, and if not, you say God, and you don't ask for any independent proof that it was God. The second point, though I don't know the details, I do know there are theories on which there's more than one universe. Things like the Big Bang have happened more than once. There's no consensus, but it is something that's out there. I just point that out.
Okay. Other questions? Blue start.
Not scientifically testable, that's for sure. So if science is your test of what exists, across the board, then you shouldn't believe in the existence of objective morality, because it doesn't really explain anything. But I think that we can know, and further, I think it's true that morality is objective. I think that there's something wrong with murder, there's something wrong with rape, there's something wrong with racism. I don't really know how to argue for that beyond just asking. I mean, if somebody told me that they really believed that, I would believe you, but I'm sure you don't live your life that way. I'm sure you don't live your life as if morality didn't exist. And there's plenty of things to be said beyond that as well. But and why did I present it? It was one of a number of arguments that I presented. It's not conclusive for sure, but if you accept that first premise, which I think you should, I think everybody should, I think it's pretty obviously true, then you should accept the conclusion. So.
Yeah, certainly the argument can be phrased as not, we hope there's morality, but you can phrase it as it's just intuitively obvious that there is morality, and whether that's a legitimate way to do ethics is a long debate that I'm not going to get into it here, because philosophers can debate that for centuries. Though, it's not clear to me what the, even if you take the first premise of his argument to be intuitively obvious, the basis for the second premise, that you have to have a God of morality, the basis for that's not clear.
Okay. Other questions?
I didn't assume that the Bible is inerrant or something like that. Biblical studies is done using the Bible as a text, and there's a wide range, just because of the nature of what you're studying, there's a wide range of positions that are taken. And probably there's people on both sides, extremely, extremely skeptical because it's the Bible, and people that are extremely conservative because it's the Bible. I would say the strength for that is that you would have to examine the New Testament text and, you know, just learn more about them. I haven't read all the stuff on it, definitely not, but from what I've heard, there's a lot of what's in there that is very reliable, which at least gives credit to the stuff that maybe isn't, can't be confirmed. And I think something like that is, I wouldn't argue from, this is what the Bible says, that they found that they found the tomb empty, and it says that it was women, therefore that's what it is. My argument is that probably this story isn't made up, because if you were making it up, why would you have women, why would you make women the ones that discover it? Because if you put yourself back in their shoes in, you know, AD 68 or whatever the author of Mark is writing, why would you pick women as the ones who discover the tomb if you're fabricating a story, because their testimony wasn't considered worth anything? So if you were fabricating a story, you would put men, or you put an apostle or somebody with authority, somebody that their audience would have trusted. The fact that it's women that they have discovering it, it's embarrassing to the story. I mean, in the first century, it's embarrassing. So if they're putting something in that's embarrassing and that it seems like they would not have made up, that gives it a lot of credibility. You think, well, yeah, if it seems like they wouldn't have made it up, then probably they didn't. That's how I was arguing for that.
Yeah. It is possible. I certainly agree that it's possible to use the New Testament as an historical text. Though, as I said, it's not a great historical text. It's not eyewitness reported. And I also would say that we don't have a lot of other documents from the time period to check it against. So a lot of the scholarship that gets done trying to determine what's true, what really happened, what didn't. It's trying to squeeze blood from a stone. We don't have a basis for those judgments, even if, probably there was a guy named Jesus who did do things along the general lines of what's described in the Gospels. But we don't have a basis for saying that it's true in all the details.
Can I make one?
Sure.
Just one remark. That particular detail, as well as basically the first two about the burial and the empty tomb, are things that are accepted by a wide range of scholars, whether they're conservative or skeptical or whatever. It's not just Christians that believe that. For example, like if you take in History 208 here with Professor Dickey, he quotes Geza Vermes, who's a Jewish New Testament scholar, and Geza Vermes believes that the tomb was found empty. So it's not just conservative Christians.
Yeah.
Your microphone?
Yeah, I didn't know the thing about Geza Vermes, but the studies I've seen the opinion, I didn't know about the one guy, but the studies I've seen on the opinions of biblical scholars, or the one study at any rate, it's 75% of scholars do think that the tomb was empty, and it's been challenged, but it's also 75% think that Jesus really rose from the dead. And I think that's like having a statistic that shows that 75% of Muslim scholars think that Muhammad would have written the Quran without divine aid, which a lot of Muslims claim. They claim he couldn't have written the Quran without divine aid. And if you find out that most Quran scholars think that, that just tells you something about Quran scholars. And it's very rare for anybody to go into biblical scholarship who's not already a Christian or Jew. The only atheists and agnostics I know of in biblical scholarship all started out as Christians, and in some cases very conservative ones.
In regards to fairness, is there anyone who has a question from a Christian perspective? Way in the back.
The historical record for the lives of the apostles isn't much better than the historical record for the lives of Jesus. So you do see, you can probably find, stories of all the apostles' martyrdom, but it's not even within the first two centuries. It's only at about 200 AD that you even find martyrdom stories for Peter and Paul. And then you start to see weird things like, Matthew getting killed in three different places. Obviously, this is not totally reliable here. The guy I mentioned, Jim Jones, he was a cult leader who got caught faking miracles, but ended up leading his group in a mass suicide nonetheless. I don't know what to make of Jones's psychology, but it happened.
Okay, just regarding the psychology of the apostles or something like that, I think this is a pretty strong point in Christianity's favor, just that it's not just one person who's a ringleader, who's crazy and who's convincing everybody else. You have a number of leaders. You have James, the brother of Jesus, who, as far as we know, during Jesus' lifetime, didn't believe in Jesus, didn't believe that he was the Messiah. And then afterwards, he's the leader of the church in Jerusalem, which is the church, basically, for many, many years up until, I think, 70 AD. Can't remember where I was going after that. What was the original question? Just remind me.
The apostles, the early church, and the lives of the apostles.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Chris is right that we don't have good historical evidence about what happened to most of the apostles. But we do, I disagree with him about Peter. I know that in the Gospel of John, it makes reference to Peter being crucified upside down. In the Gospel of John, purports to be written by an eyewitness, and I don't know if there's any good reason to doubt that, but it's definitely written within the first century or like 80, 90 to maybe very early in the next century. Depends on what scholar you're looking at, I think. But I mean, we have a physical copy of it that dates from, I think, AD 118 maybe. And then Paul, we have pretty good documentation of his life, and I don't think there's any reason to doubt that he was martyred in Rome. And I know Peter and Paul, we have pretty good evidence for how they died. And we know that Christians were dying for their faith, and we don't have any record of any that defected other than maybe Judas. So,
I'm not going to respond to all of that, but a couple of factual points. I've read the book of John. You might think that it's implied that Peter was crucified there, but it's certainly not explicit. And the so-called copy of the book of John he mentioned from the early second century is a credit card-sized fragment. It's not an entire manuscript. Just two factual points there.
Okay. Other questions?
And in definitely in the physical sciences, a about just what is valid as far as like methodology. Basically, like a lot of philosophers and scientists bring in an assumption of metaphysical naturalism. Metaphysical naturalism being something like the only thing that exists is physical stuff and what science can show us to exist. And so if you come in with that idea, obviously you're going to conclude that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, God doesn't exist, because, I mean, it's just not compatible with your ideas that you're bringing in. And likewise for the Christian should be able to step outside of his theistic belief and say, you know, what reason is there to believe this, even if his belief isn't necessarily grounded in arguments or something like that. They should be able to step outside and assess different arguments and things like that from a perspective that isn't their own.
Okay, we have time for two more questions. We'll take one here.
Free will. Do we have it, or would you say that we are merely cognitive creatures?
Sorry, what was that again?
Free will.
Oh, free will.
We have
oh,
it.
Gosh. That's a hard one. I guess I have to say that I honestly don't know. I think that just, you know, as a personal note about myself, as someone who studied philosophy, the arguments against free will that really get me aren't the ones from, like, you know, naturalism is true. In fact, I'm not even sure quite what people mean when they say naturalism. There are arguments against free will that have to do with, does this concept make any sense, which is a whole series of philosophy lectures. Those I don't quite know, and those I don't know, quite know what to make of.
So you're undecided.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe we do have free will, and definitely at least part of my reason for believing that is because I believe God has free will, and he created us and we're made in his image, and it doesn't seem to me that, there's two different kinds of free will. There's libertarian free will and compatibilist free will. At least those are the two main kinds. I don't think compatibilist free will being the kind that sort of assumes determinism, I don't think that really is free will. So, I haven't studied a whole lot on it, but I've never heard an argument that was all that convincing against free will, against libertarian free will anyways. So.
Okay. Final question?
Different sects, but as far as I know, none of them had the view that the resurrection was something that could happen in the middle of history in two parts. Like there could be a first part where one man is raised from the dead, and then history could continue, and they would still expect a resurrection at the end. I don't think I'm wrong when I say that there is no sect that we know of that believed that or anything like that. The resurrection was something that happened at the end of history to all the righteous. Maybe all the righteous and all the unrighteous or something. And then regarding the Messiah, I would basically say the same thing. As far as I know, from what I've read of New Testament scholarship, they had we know pretty much what their expectation of the Messiah was, and that there's nothing compatible with a Messiah being crucified. I mean, I quoted Deuteronomy where it states that somebody who hangs on a tree is cursed by God. So Jesus being crucified on a tree, they would have believed that he was cursed by God. They definitely would have believed that he was a failed Messiah. And so the fact that they continue to believe that he was a Messiah is remarkable, really. And I guess as far as where you could look to confirm whether or not what I'm saying is true, I know that E.P. Sanders and Geza Paramus are two of the scholars that have done a lot of research into what the first century Jewish beliefs were. And I mean, if you look up William Lane Craig and some of his arguments, he'll cite people that he gets this from as well. So you can check it out for yourself.
Okay. There are a number of points here. One is the issue of the Jewish concept of the Messiah. Jesus did not fit the Jewish concept of the Messiah, but I actually think that's a problem for Christianity, because the things about the Messiah conquering and making everything wonderful, that's very well rooted in the Old Testament. And things were not all wonderful for Israel after Jesus came. Like, it was within a few decades Jerusalem was destroyed. So it seems to be a very serious internal inconsistency within the Bible. As for the idea of the resurrection, notice that in Paul's letters, he talks about Jesus as the first fruits of the general resurrection that's going to happen at the end of days. This is not a radical break with previous Jewish theology. This is a matter of gradual evolution. And the third question is, after Jesus was crucified, when they had given up believing in him, that seems very intuitive, but it actually doesn't fit with what we know about the sociology of a lot of religious movements, especially apocalyptic movements that say the world is going to end soon, which Jesus' movement may have been. You find the famous case study is a book called When Prophecy Failed, dealing with the UFO group. And the bottom line is that when religious groups have their expectations frustrated, they often find very creative ways to rationalize the failures that they've seen. And I think that's also probably part of the explanation for why the early Christians came to believe in the resurrection.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention one other source. N.T. Wright wrote a book called The Challenge of Jesus, and there's a single chapter in there on the resurrection of Jesus that you could go to and read it. You could probably just do it in orders or something. You don't even have to buy it. But N.T. Wright is one of the most well-respected New Testament scholars. He'll explain that for you.
Okay. Since we have 3 minutes more, and since this girl in the pink shirt looked like she's going to pee her pants, you can have a
hug.
I've never really looked into Islam too much, but a friend of mine said when he was looking into the different religions, he spent, not very long on Islam at all, because he said that it sounded to him like the kind of religion that you would make up. Like, it's based on how good you are, the kind of works that you do, like earning your salvation, appeasing God, and things like when you go to heaven, you get however many virgins or something like that. He said, I mean, that sounded to him like something a man would make up. Christianity does not seem that way at all. It's it's by grace. It's not based on works. I think that humans we definitely have this desire to achieve whatever it is that we're going to get. We have this desire to earn it. And the idea that something would come free to us, but that we would have to approach God humbly, isn't so intuitive. So as much as I have an answer to Christianity versus Islam, that would be it. But maybe I should do more reading into it.
Well, Josh, if you want to talk about historical evidence for miracle claims, the Mormons have an affidavit allegedly signed by 3 people attesting to an angel coming down to verify the Book of the Mormon. I don't really think Christianity isn't any better than that. You can argue, but Christians don't believe it, and I don't think they should. Whether Christianity is the kind of thing you make up. If you look at Christian doctrine, it looks, at least how you get salvation looks like exactly the kind of thing you make up. The very common idea throughout the Bible, arguably the Bible contradicts itself at a point, but a very common idea is that Christians go to heaven, everybody else goes to hell. I can give you like 5 examples, but here's one from the 3rd chapter of John is whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already because he has not believed in the name of God's one and only Son. This is exactly the kind of thing you'd make up if you were the leader of a tiny first century cult and you were like, how do I get people to join this? Oh yeah, I'll tell them that everybody who joins me goes to heaven and everybody who doesn't goes to hell.
Okay, fair enough. So now we're going to have 4-minute closings where basically the 2 speakers can sum up what they've talked about. Afterwards, I'm going to ask that they put up the websites that refer to their particular groups and any of the authors that they remember that they've referenced. So if you guys want to learn more, you can always look into the stuff that they'll write on the board.
Okay. Obviously, I don't have time to rehash everything we've talked over tonight, but I'd like to emphasize just a couple main points. First, the idea of trying to look at the religious beliefs that you have, or even the ones you were raised in, even if you're not so sure about them, try and look at them from the perspective of an outsider. I've mentioned with the evidence, the issue of miracles, Christians are happy to dismiss the statements about the angel coming down from heaven that the Mormons have. Most of them probably don't even know about it. Or the issue of prayer, come up with ideas of why God doesn't answer prayer, but I don't think anybody would consider these explanations for a moment if they were given as explanations for why a voodoo ritual failed, or if I claim to have psychic powers and then I start making up rationalizations for why I can't provide evidence of them. You wouldn't accept that. Just thinking about these things in general, the one thing that's wonderful about debates like this is that everybody kind of comes with the agreement that it's okay to sort of critically discuss religion. Some people in today's society seem to think that religion is off topics and the best thing to do is just not talk about it. Those are the 2 things I'd emphasize. And oh, one other thing, please, this goes for non-Christians, but especially Christians, please read the Bible. Seriously. I am serious. Like, you could listen to the stories of, people who were raised Christians, and then they weren't so sure, and you asked them where their doubts began. It was actually, a matter of sitting down and saying, oh, the Bible says that, and it says that. And, I've been quoting a few things from the Bible for that reason, and people start to notice the contradictions. I suppose Tim would hope that reading the Bible gets people to believe, but certainly it makes you better informed. And I've read it cover to cover. I still am. I still try to read it regularly. But that's all I have to say. Yeah, just keep thinking and discussing. And yeah.
not God exists, whether or not Christianity is true or not, is the most important question in life. I can't think of anything that's more important, because think about the consequences. If it is true or if it isn't true, they're huge. And you should base your whole life on, I mean, your life should change based on how you answer that question and your beliefs on it. But I would also say not to approach it in any kind of a cavalier manner. I mean, approach it with the respect that it deserves. And regardless of where you start, I mean, definitely where you start, where I started, affected greatly how I approach the question, how I think about it. But just from my perspective as a Christian, I believe that God exists. I believe that God created us to know Him, that we're sinners, that we don't deserve to know Him, but that He made a way for us to know Him through Jesus. And I don't know what the role of arguments are necessarily in my own belief. I've thought about this. Why am I a Christian? Why do I believe it? I can't point to a single argument and say I'm a Christian because of this. I can probably say that if I didn't think the resurrection was as plausible as it was, or if I looked into it and thought, man, this is no reason to believe this, this is clearly false, I probably wouldn't be a Christian today. But I can't say for sure. I mean, definitely not the cosmological argument isn't the reason I believe God exists. Maybe if I had to answer that question, I would say I think God exists because I think I've experienced Him. I think that I've experienced His love. I think that He does love me. I think that He loves all of you. And Chris talked a lot about just why isn't it more obvious that God exists, and why hasn't God done more to promote that belief among people? And I think that He sent His Son, He sent Jesus, and we see who God is in Jesus. And I would encourage you to read the Bible. I would encourage you to read the Bible within context, and don't think that everything that we bring into it as 21st century Americans and how we read it is how the original authors and the original audience understood it. Do some research. Look into it. Look into alleged contradictions. Look into these stories in the Old Testament that seem so implausible, and ask yourself why, or look into what do they mean to the people who originally read it. But Jeremiah 29 says, this is allegedly, this is God speaking to His people in exile. He says, "Then you will call upon Me and come and pray to Me, and I will listen to you. You will seek Me and find Me when you seek Me with all your heart. I will be found by you." And James 4, 6 to 8 says, "God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves now to God. Come near to God, and He will come near to you." I think that if any of us approaches God with humility and not with demands about what we expect Him to be to us, what we expect Him to say or to present Himself to us, if we approach Him with openness, with an attitude of love and with humility, I think God will show Himself to be real to any of us. So I would encourage you to do that if you haven't already. Just see what happens.
All right, thanks so much for coming to the debate today. Let's give our speakers another round of applause.